argument now in the case of United States against Mikos. Mr. Levenstam.
May it please the Court. My plan for this morning is subject, of course, to any questions from the Court, in particular how the government violated Dr. Mikos's constitutional rights in closing arguments, both in trial and in sentencing. And with leave of the Court, I will begin with the sentencing hearing and then work back to the trial, because the trial closing issues interlock with a series of issues pertaining to the missing guns that are fairly complex, and I do want to address the sentencing. The government, in closing at the sentencing, seized on remorse as a theme to focus the jury's attention on the fact that Dr. Mikos did not testify. They started out by saying, and I quote, "He's 20 feet away from you, and there's nothing, no remorse whatsoever, because he thinks he got away with it." Now, the only way that Dr. Mikos could express remorse in this context would be to take the stand and apologize, but he maintains his innocence. There is no apology to the jury, and the fact that the prosecutor places him in proximity to the jury in the argument, I think, emphasizes that fact. The prosecutor then hammers on that theme, putting words essentially of apology into Dr. Mikos' mouth, which I think exacerbates the problem with the silence here, by saying things like, "He's sorry he forgot the bullets in his car. He's sorry the FBI found the Skokie guns. He's sorry that Charles Lobosco decided to cooperate and testify against him, and he's sorry that he got caught, but he's not sorry that he shot Joyce Brannon." And then again, the government says, "He's sitting opposite you right now, nothing else in that man's heart, not a single thing. He has no remorse for what he did." Again, the focus of the proximity of the man to the jury is an emphasis on the fact that he has not apologized, which is the only way to express remorse. And what the government is doing is attempting to get the jury to draw the conclusion from his silence that he is not remorseful. And that, of course, was an aggravating factor qualifying him for the death sentence.
Would it have been all right if he would not have said it was 20 feet away?
No, but that exacerbates the problem. And when you weigh this in context, I think that puts the thumb much more heavily on the side of the violation.
Fundamentally the same argument as a contention that it would be unconstitutional to give anybody a three-level reduction for pleading guilty. That's a form of showing remorse, but it depends on the defendant standing up in open court and saying, "Yes, I agree, I did it." The criminal process is just full of distinctions between people who stand up and express remorse and get a lower sentence and people who refuse to and don't.
Well, that's true, but not what's going on here, Your Honor, is not reducing a sentence for an expression of remorse. It is enhancing a sentence, and indeed...
I don't know that I understand the difference. There is... In either event, there's a difference between what happens to you if you fess up to your wrongdoing and what happens to you if you don't.
Well, I believe that there is a clear difference, Your Honor, and that is that if you fess up, you can have your sentence reduced, arguably, under the sentencing guidelines. But if you do not fess up, that is a condition that can bring death upon you, in other words, enhance your sentence for remaining silent. And I do believe that is a violation of the Constitution, and I believe that's essentially what was going on when the Supreme Court declared that...
Could you explain to me why, if an incentive to fess up and get a lower sentence is not a violation of the Constitution, this particular incentive is? In either event, there is a distinction between what happens to you if you talk and what happens to you if you don't. And I would think you would be arguing that that distinction is the penalty on the exercise of a constitutional right and therefore unconstitutional, and therefore you have to tell me why the reduction for acceptance of responsibility isn't unconstitutional.
Well, it may well be. It's not an argument I've staked out here.
Well,
there is a...
Would you have any objection if they had said to your client that if he pleaded guilty, they would not ask for death?
In a No, not in a conference, no, but sitting in front of the jury that's going to...
Did they offer that, or did you ask?
I was not trial counsel, Your Honor. I was appointed by this court on appeal. But there is a distinction, which I think the Jackson court, the Supreme Court recognized in Jackson, which is that if you can have your penalty enhanced for remaining silent, which is essentially what is going on here, because remember, you have to find, beyond a reasonable doubt, aggravating factors to qualify for the death penalty. And if your silence is taken as evidence of remorse, which is the qualifying factor for death penalty, and without an aggravating factor you cannot be sentenced to death, then that is an enhanced punishment.
Well, do you think there's any situation where lack of remorse could be an aggravating factor?
Yes, I do believe that there are sentences, situations where a lack of remorse can be an aggravating factor, but they cannot hinge on silence.
What would be an example?
Well, an example would be, as certain cases have reflected, where the defendant in open court is openly disrespectful of the judge, calling people names, or is attempting to intimidate witnesses from the stand, and his conduct reflects a lack of remorse.
The intimidation of witnesses is obstruction of justice. That's not lack of remorse.
Well, but it demonstrates, I believe, it demonstrates a lack of remorse.
Well, what if he's just gleeful and he laughs when the murder is described and something like that? Would that be proper?
He cackles as he runs away from the scene of the crime, as it always happens on TV.
Well, that may indicate lack of remorse, but we don't have anything like that here.
Proof that he cackled as he was leaving the scene of the crime and then boasted to his friends that he was a great criminal. See Leopold and Loeb, you would still be saying it's a violation of the Constitution because he might have been remorseful since then and couldn't show that he was remorseful without testifying.
But what distinguishes this case is that it is the fact of his silence that the government is playing upon to get the aggravating factor of remorse.
I don't see why that's just related to his silence. Why do you tie that to his silence?
Because the only way that he can express remorse in the context of the sentencing hearing is to take the stand and testify. And when they talk about him sitting there a few feet from you and with nothing in his heart, that is they are plainly pointing at the fact that he is... They're highlighting for the jury and asking the jury to conclude from his silence that he is not remorseful. Now, the Hall and Dickinson cases from the Texas courts indicate that, and I think Lesko from the Third Circuit.
Is lack of remorse ever used as an aggravating factor in an ordinary sentencing case?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think that the way that that is taken account of, as Judge Easterbrook has indicated, is there are potential
reductions.
That's
what I find curious about this case. Yeah,
it is taken into
account. It's always a defendant's mitigating factor. It's not a prosecutor's aggravating factor. I've never seen it as an aggravating factor.
Right. Well, suppose this were changed. Suppose remorse were made a mitigating factor. You know, the law were changed so that it said, we assume lack of remorse. We assume the defendant is happy with his crime unless he does something to show us that he is remorseful.
I would be arguing here that that assumption, that that statute is unconstitutional, Your Honor.
As Judge Posner pointed out, that's exactly what happens in the normal case where the sentence is imprisonment.
Well, it's a little different, Your Honor, because the sentencing guidelines set a range of sentences that you get, and they authorize the judge to lower that if the judge concludes that there is a genuine assumption of responsibility.
I think you're making a simple point. I think you're saying that the remorse issue in ordinary sentencing is asymmetrical. Defendant argues remorse, government counters it. The defendant doesn't argue remorse. The government doesn't come along and say lack of remorse. Give him a bonus punishment. that true?
I do believe it's asymmetrical, and I think that the Constitution, at least in the context of gathering evidence from silence about remorse, I think the Constitution requires that, and I think basically that's what Jackson indicates. There is a second constitutional facet to this silence issue, and that is the Sixth Amendment.
I wouldn't emphasize the Constitution. I'll ask Mr. Bindi, but I don't understand lack of remorse. Well, I didn't understand how. I mean, I can imagine being demonstrated by gleefulness. I'm not sure what. I'm not sure what else they think demonstrates lack of remorse, except failure to confess.
There is another error here in terms of the closing and sentencing, which I'd like to touch upon, and that is the argument focusing the jury on what Ms. Brannon was thinking after she was shot as she was dying. The government argued, and what was she thinking? What was she thinking when she sat there for 3 or 4 minutes dying? We heard from the medical examiner that it took 3 or 4 minutes for her to die when the blood went into her lungs. What was she thinking? That argument is a four-square violation of what they call the golden rule, that you do not have a jury put itself in the place of the victim. And that is exactly what happened. And the government's citation to the Grossman case is patently distinguishable on its face. And even the Grossman decision notes that golden rule types of arguments like this are not
proper. Has the vulnerable victim aggravating factor been questioned?
We challenged it on the facts because of the relevance, but we haven't questioned the underlying constitutionality.
What struck me as odd here is that I don't see how her weight affects her vulnerability to being shot. You can't outrun a bullet. So I wondered whether that had been raised.
That has been raised. But even beyond that, this argument focuses not on, although it was cloaked in the guise of this vulnerability argument, it had nothing to do with vulnerability because it focused in on the time after she was shot. Which, apart from the factual issue that the medical examiner said he had no idea, she may very well have been unconscious.
No, I understand your what was she thinking argument, but it was the vulnerability seemed to me.
We argued that that is
misplaced.
We argued that that was improper too. I would like to turn, if I may, now to the missing gun, which the government used in closing. Just like remorse, to focus the jury on Dr. Mikos' silence. They primed the pump, if you will, in opening by saying the only possible explanation for this gun being missing is because he didn't want it brought in here. Then objection was raised and overruled, and the government repeated the point. And then in rebuttal closing at the end, the government really went to town, if you will. Referring to the defense counsel, Ms. Giacchetti, the government said, and I quote, "She is right when she says defendant does not have to tell you where the gun is. He does not have to say a word. He does not have to tell you where the gun is. That this is not a game of hide-and-go-seek." So as I count it, that's three specific comments on his silence that are disguised as a supposed response to the defendant's counsel's argument, except the defendant's counsel never made that argument in closing. All she said was, and I quote, "It's not my burden to solve the murder." She did not comment on the fact that her client had not said where the gun was. As in the Cottenham case, what the prosecutor did was acknowledge that the defendant had no obligation to testify in a fashion that essentially highlighted and cast negative inference on the fact that the defendant had not testified, and that in Cottenham was determined to be reversible error. And those comments bad enough as they were followed by this hide-and-go-seek comment, which is a flat-out accusation that Dr. Mikos was hiding from the jury by not testifying. Now, the government also...
I just don't think that's a fair argument. The government obviously is going to harp on the fact that that gun wasn't found, despite all the efforts to find it. And then he had a book about how to hide anything or something like that. I don't see how what they did here...
Following on the heels of three comments that he hasn't said where the gun is, he doesn't have to say where the gun is, hide-and-go-seek is a game where someone runs and hides. And it is a comment not about... It's not where you hide something. It's where the player hides himself. And that's what anyone who's played hide-and-go-seek knows. And I believe that was specifically designed to have the jury think about the fact that he was hiding from them. Now, as I said, the gun, they also exploited the gun.
Well, speaking of the gun, going to the guilt issue for a second.
Yes.
You don't discuss in your brief, do you, or maybe you do, and I miss it, that the serial number on the gun matches the type of Schmidt weapon that has the eight grooves.
The serial number on the gun matches makes it a Model 21, which is, according to the General Rifling Characteristics database, a six-groove weapon. The murder bullets were eight-groove. So there were all four of the Model 21 Herbert Schmidts in the GRC were six-grooved, not eight. And so they did not match up. And we made that argument in the context of our Daubert argument addressing the relevance prong of Daubert, where we said that the murder bullets all have eight grooves and lands, but all Model 21s in the GRC have six, and that's spelled out at page 2190 of the transcript. Now, Mr. Tangren, Agent Tangren, when he testified, when he went to pick up his demos, he chose two different models. He did not choose a Model 21 to demo fire. He chose two models that have eight grooves. He picked a model that the distributor had labeled a deputy marshal and a model that the distributor had labeled an L.A. deputy, even though, according to the Skokie inventory, Dr. Mikos' Model 21 had neither of those designations on it, and Skokie Officer O'Brien said he would have noted those designations on the inventory sheet if they'd been on the weapon. And what's more, Agent Tangren didn't even know, he hadn't even checked whether his collection had a Herbert Schmidt Model 21. So he didn't even know whether he had the actual gun that was used. Clearly, and that's he stated that at page 2187 of the transcript. So clearly, he has not, his demo testimony is based on irrelevant demo guns. And even with respect to those improper, wrong guns, his methodology was not reliable and didn't satisfy the Daubert standard. As he admitted, there were no published studies about the kind of analysis that he was doing, and that's at 2112.
I think it was the serial number that the government relied on to show that it was a gun that had eight grooves.
No, there was no. The government never argued that.
Evidence of that? There's no evidence of that.
The government never argued that it had eight grooves. The government just argued it was the same in general, that it was a Herbert Schmidt 22. The government never. No one ever testified that his Model 21 had eight grooves, that Model 21s generally had eight grooves. No one. And that's a very important point. And I want to be very clear about that. The serial number, Eudora Huggy, the ATF person, testified that the serial number reflected that it was a Model 21. There were four Model 21s in the GRC database. All were six grooves. With respect to the methodology, there are no published studies on the analysis that he conducted. He confessed that there were no industry standards for determining what was a match or what was, quote, consistent. He also, and the government acknowledged this, there were no error rates for this sort of analysis. All of these are key aspects of qualifying for Daubert. And what's more, he then made up his own marginal rates of error for his measurements. He didn't even report what his actual measurements were. He took a measurement and added to either side. And when he made his consistency finding, it was based on overlapping ranges. There was not a match even between the measurement and the range. They were overlapping ranges. And so this is precisely the type of junk science that Daubert was decided to prevent.
Why do you continually refer to Daubert? It was replaced by Rule 702.
I apologize, Your Honor. Rule 702.
In the language of Rule 702, how would you phrase your argument?
I would phrase it as there are insufficient facts or data because the demo guns that he used were not the proper gun, and I would say that and that may also go to the reliability of applying to this case. And then I would also say that his methodology fails under the second standard.
The thing that gives me, if you praise it in those terms, what gives me trouble with your argument is that all this FBI witness was stating was a possibility theorem. FBI witness said, we have in our database data that show that some guns like this had 8 grooves. He wasn't stating more than a possibility theorem. He wasn't stating, I am demonstrating from this database that the gun owned by Mikos had 8 grooves. It was just some guns of this type had 8 grooves. Now, why, as a possibility theorem, what's the problem with it?
I just went through all the reliability aspects that I think are flawed, which I think come under the product of reliable principles and methods rule of Rule 702. But this is what 702 was designed to keep out. This is basically junk science. There's nothing. This really doesn't winnow anything down because...
You may be missing my question. My question is that this is not science at all, right? This is like somebody who stands by the side of the road and says, I've seen 75 or 100 swans fly overhead, and 5 of them are black, and I now want to testify that some swans are black.
Well, he certainly couched it as science, talking about his measurements and so on and so forth. And I think that was error. He should not have been permitted to do that. And what's more, the database reflects 6 grooves for all 4 of these type of guns. Not one of them in the database had 8. And to aggravate this problem further, the government took what you described as the identifying colored swans testimony and changed it in closing argument radically. They said in opening, they started out by saying that Paul Tangren said one of the guns in this limited field was a .22 caliber Herbert Schmidt revolver, the exact gun that the Skokie police returned to Ronald Mikos. Well, it was not the exact gun. He never fired the exact kind of gun. In fact, the exact kind of gun is only reflected as having 6 grooves, not 8. In closing, they said Paul Tangren went and got that gun out of his collection and fired it. And what do you know? They match. The rifling characteristics match. Well, it wasn't that gun, and it couldn't have been that gun because the only 4 that guns in the database were 6 grooves, not 8 grooves, and could not possibly have matched. And there was never a match. I mean, he was only talking about consistency in any event. And
so
finally, in rebuttal,
why didn't his testimony help you rather than hurt you?
Well, why? Because he is the FBI agent, the expert witness, giving an ultimate conclusion that says it could have been our gun.
His evidence supported you.
Well, I guess it's a friend I don't want, I sense. This is,
well, I know. I think, on the contrary, if the witness for your opponent gives evidence that makes your case, That's the best. That's much better than having your own witness.
But in the end, what he did was he opined as an expert that this gun was of the type that could have fired the bullet,
didn't
the government...
Didn't you have a devastating riposte?
Based on his own testimony. I think the defense...
Couldn't you say, well, that's his conclusion, but conclusion doesn't follow from his own evidence. His own evidence gun couldn't be the same.
Yes, you could say that, and they attempted to do that. But his opinion was unshaken.
Well, why isn't that adequate to put the issue before the jury?
And, well, because Rule 702 is specifically designed to exclude this.
You see, look how, if you'd gotten your expert, it would hurt you. Because your expert would say that database is no good. But it's the database that shows that a Model 21 has six grooves, which is your best evidence.
Well, Your Honor... again, I think that the evidence should have been excluded in its entirety. The conclusion that
it
could have been...
You wouldn't be any better off with the evidence excluded in its entirety.
The government could certainly
show that there's a missing gun.
I don't think that's all they really need. I don't think anybody... In this circumstance...
She's shot with a .22 and there's a missing gun.
There are thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of .22s in this world.
Oh, there are hardly.
Thousands of them, in any event. Yeah.
She's shot with a .22, and he's a suspect on many other grounds, and he lost his .22.
Your Honor,
it's not only that his .22 has gone missing, but elaborate searches failed to bring it up. So it's clearly been hidden.
Well, or somebody stole it out of the trunk of the car, and somebody has it in their home, which you would never look for. But in any event,
why would you steal that gun out of your trunk?
I wouldn't, but someone might. Someone might want a gun. In any event, Your Honor, I don't think you can conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that this would have helped us and made the better case for us, and that we were better off without the expert that we requested, who I think would have done a very fine job of rebutting a testimony that gave them the opportunity to make this killer closing argument, which was improper. And so I'd like to reserve, if I might, the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you very much.
Certainly, Mr. Levenstam. Mr. Bindi.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'd like to take up the last issue first and begin by reminding the Court that the evidence tying the demonstration gun to the missing .22 that was in the defendant's possession at least 3 days before the murder did not come from the testimony of Special Agent Tangren from the FBI. It came from the witness who followed him, which was ATF firearms expert Robert Burroughs. He testified that he had seen many deputy combos, which was the gun that the defendant had. Serial number on the gun.
Isn't that the real dispute, whether it was a deputy combo or a Model 21?
Whether or not it was, the serial number says it was both. It was both a deputy combo and a Model 21. But according to Special Agent Burroughs' testimony, he had seen many deputy combos, and he had also seen many deputy marshals, and they are the same gun. In his experience, they are the same gun. So that's what ties the missing gun to the demo gun. As far as the admissibility of the GRC database testimony goes, I think it's important to bear in mind that all Special Agent Tangren testified to was that the defendant's .22 pistol could not be excluded as the murder weapon based on a comparison of the bullets from the victim to bullets fired by
a... Possibility theorem.
The fact
that the bird was black does not preclude it from being a swan.
Precisely.
Defendant trying to exclude that evidence? Was the defendant trying to exclude the evidence of the missing gun?
Yes, Your Honor. The defendant tried to exclude the evidence on Fifth Amendment grounds because it called into question his failure to explain what happened to the gun.
No, I understand that, but I mean, at the trial, was it that he didn't want your side to offer any evidence that the missing gun could have been the murder weapon?
Well, other than on Fifth Amendment grounds, no, Your Honor. He tried to exclude the evidence about the database.
I'm just wondering why bother to go through all this ballistic stuff. When it just say she was killed with a .22, this .22 is missing, you know, QED, what more would you want?
Well, I will concede that that the evidence from the GRC database, the comparison of the question bullets to the bullets fired by the test gun, advances the ball only marginally. There's other excellent evidence, I think, in the government's arsenal regarding, you know, tying these things together. The evidence of the bullets that were recovered from the from the defendant's car, you know, that these were 22 long rifle brass coated rimfire cartridges with multiple knurled cannelures, and that that's consistent with the bullets recovered from the victim. I think that's very strong evidence that it was the defendant's weapon that killed the victim. But I think that the evidence that Special Agent Tangerine testified about was sufficiently reliable to be admitted before the jury. The scientific technique here essentially involves observing spent rounds for barrel rifling markings. And the defendant's own authorities agree that if the bullet itself is not overly mangled, this is easy to do. Beyond that, the technique involved very precise measurements at a microscopic level of land width. All of the entries in the database are peer reviewed because they're double checked by FBI agents before they go in. The error rate may not be known, but presumably it is small because this is a database that is relied on by law enforcement agencies worldwide. And the testimony was,
I don't understand the argument that something is peer reviewed if the data are checked before they go in. If the local McDonald's has a second cashier check the daily tapes of the first cashier, does that mean that the data is peer reviewed?
Well, it means that there's double checking for error.
Yeah, but that's common in accounting systems, but that's not what one normally means by peer reviewed.
Well, peer review, I suppose, in this context, would have to do with whether or not viewing barrel rifling markings
are. Means is somebody writes a scholarly analysis and it's submitted to somebody else in the field for analysis and review before it's published. It's a totally different concept from did A check B's work before it went into a computer database.
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that under the Kumho case, these Daubert factors are applicable only to the extent that...
But because scientific evidence is the best evidence, you're using scientific lingo to describe what is not
scientific
activity.
Well, then,
so,
you know, then
it's a kind of,
again, my point here, Your Honor, is
semantic extravagance.
My point here is that the Daubert factors...
You're saying it's reliable, nothing to do with peer review. You're saying reliable because it was checked.
Mm-hmm. That's basically our point.
That's fine.
Turning now, Your Honors, to the arguments regarding the prosecutor's closing argument, both in the penalty phase and at the trial phase. The argument complained of at the penalty phase, the present objection is forfeited because there was no objection at the penalty phase to what the prosecutor argued. There was evidence of overt actions from which one could make an inference of lack of remorse.
And yeah, that's but what's really disturbing to me is, I mean, I think your lack of remorse factors about the fraud, I don't think they're very persuasive either, but clearly the key thing is you ask the jury to look at the guy, and you're saying that because he hasn't confessed, he shows lack of remorse, and this becomes a reason for executing him.
I don't believe
that puts him in an extremely uncomfortable position, right?
Your Honor, I don't believe.
I mean, did you offer him a deal where if he pleaded guilty, you wouldn't ask for a death sentence?
I couldn't say whether or not there was any bargaining over this prior to the trial.
That would be one thing, but I think if he doesn't have that assurance, I mean, look at his situation. He's got a colorable, may not be very strong. He's got a colorable a challenge to his conviction, you know, based on the gun and so on. And the other break-ins to her apartment and so forth. He's got, you know, something there. And you're saying if he doesn't give that up, you're going to whack him with lack of remorse.
I would disagree that that's what the prosecutor's argument was based on, Your Honor. Again, there was evidence of overt actions.
Well, when they say look at him, all they see is that he's silent. Nothing else to see about him.
There is a context surrounding that particular statement. And the context is that the prosecutor is arguing based on the evidence that the defendant, even after he was arrested, continued to make at least one false claim on Medicaid. So he's continuing to execute the scheme to defraud. He's calling patients from his jail to try and encourage them not to cooperate with investigators and to lie to the investigators on his behalf. He's calling from jail. He's calling his girlfriend, Stacy Rosenfeld, and he's telling her that all of this is going to blow over in a couple of weeks because the government has nothing on him.
Was that evidence offered in the guilt phase or the sentencing phase?
That came in the sentencing phase, Your Honor.
Not in the guilt
phase.
Look, I think you're doing double counting. It's a premeditated murder. It's a murder incidental to a fraudulent scheme. That marks him as a bad person. That's fine. That's your major aggravating factor. But it's just double counting to say, oh, by the way, he lacks remorse. And look, if you think of the ordinary sentencing, it's asymmetrical. The defendant asks for acceptance of responsibility if he's pleaded guilty. But if he goes to trial, you don't say to the judge, well, not only should you deny him acceptance of responsibility, you should tack on an additional sentence because he didn't accept responsibility, right? You don't do that. Now, if he obstructs justice, he lies, so forth, fine. You don't have that here. So this is unique in my experience that you use non-acceptance of responsibility not just to wipe out a discount, but to get a bonus sentence, especially a death sentence.
Well, in the typical case, Your Honor, there is nothing beyond the commission of the crime itself that could be pointed to by way of saying, you know, not only did the defendant commit this crime, but he's heartless. I mean, he has no remorse. You don't typically have evidence of something to support an argument like that in most cases. But again, in this case, we have actions that the defendant took after he is arrested for the fraud, continuing to try and obstruct
Look,
justice.
You can harp on the actions, but surely the most powerful evidence that your prosecutor offered the jury was to say, look at the guy, he's 20 feet away. I mean, that's the powerful thing. That's saying to him, look, if he were remorseful, you're telling the jury, if he were remorseful, he would confess. That's what you're saying. That puts him in a very difficult position. And it's so unnecessary.
I disagree that that is what the prosecutor argued, and I think, Your Honor, that nobody in the courtroom thought that that's what the prosecutor was arguing because everyone was sensitized to this issue. Prior to argument in the penalty phase.
What other function is the look at him serving? Was it an argument that he was sneering or making faces?
I can't really speak to that. I sincerely doubt that that's the case. In the typical trial, my back is to the defendant most of the time. So, especially when I'm arguing to the jury.
Of course, you can always tell who the murderer is because they always sneer and give themselves away at the right moment.
That's how I
will take it that you're not making that argument here.
No. No.
I'm also troubled by the vulnerable victim business. It seems to me vulnerability has to be relative to the nature of the crime. So we had a case a number of years ago, I think Lalamon was called, in which the defendant was a closeted homosexual, married, had a homosexual escapade, and is blackmailed by the person. And he was extremely vulnerable because he was closeted and married and so on. I think he tried to kill himself. But if you're dealing with a murder by shooting, I don't see how being obese is relevant vulnerability. You can't, if she weighed 125 pounds, she couldn't outrun those bullets. What difference could her weight have made to her likelihood of being killed?
If she was 125 pounds, Your Honor, she may have been able to get out of that chair.
Get out of the chair. Someone's standing inches behind, right? Wasn't one of the shots, wasn't there powder, maybe I'm confusing another case, wasn't there powder birds in the bullet hole?
There were six shots fired. Presumably the first three went into her back. There was no stippling around those. She fell back into the chair with her right arm pinned behind her. Then there were two shots to the neck and the chin. Exhibited stippling.
She's not living in a mansion, right? Even if she could run fleetly, where is she going to run? He's standing behind her with a gun. He's no more than, a couple of feet away.
That may be true, Your Honor.
So she rises quickly. So that means she's shot lower down in her back. It just doesn't make any sense.
If she had been more mobile, she may have been able to defend herself from an attacker, even with a gun.
Not with her back to the attacker.
Well, again, we submit that she was shot with her back to the attacker because she could not get out of the chair. Had she been able to get out of the chair quicker and turn at that distance, she might have been able to grab the arm or the hand holding the firearm and defend herself. This was a middle-aged alcoholic who was assaulting her. And if she had not been handicapped, she may have been able, if not to flee, at least to defend herself. She might have stood a fighting chance. She didn't have that. We submit that. Oh, I wanted to turn to the what was she thinking argument and make a mention of that as well. We've argued that argument was addressed to the fact that the victim suffered. It did not ask the jurors to basically put themselves in that chair and ask how they would feel.
No one actually knows Did the other side make equally absurd arguments? Is the notion that what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander? If they make some ridiculous sentimental argument, you're entitled to rebut in kind. I think that would be fine. Actually.
If the argument that being human is a mitigating factor, for example.
But what did they say? Did they say, this fellow's young children, loves his mother, or what? Did they indulge in that kind of malarkey that opened the door for you guys?
They submitted a lengthy list of mitigating factors, Your Honor. Among them, first of all, none of them was found unanimously by the jury. Some of them were found by about half of the jurors, and the mitigating factors that were the most popular among the jury all had to do with the defendant's close and loving relationship with his son, his nonviolent past, and his efforts to get mental health treatment for his depression and his substance abuse. So those were the ones that the jury found most mitigating. The jury also came up with a mitigating factor of its own, which was that state and federal regulatory agencies were slow to respond to this podiatrist's fraud and his conduct. again, this is this closing argument is reviewed for plain error because there was no objection at the time. We think that's a telling point because everybody in the courtroom understood this argument to be made based on the evidence and not on demeanor in the courtroom. And finally, turning to the closing argument at the guilt phase of the trial. Again, taking this in context, it's clear what the prosecutor was saying. In his opening argument, the prosecutor said, the gun is missing because the defendant didn't want it here. He's talking about the gun being missing, and that's a fair inference from the evidence, and it's a proper argument. In the closing, the prosecutor said the gun was not misplaced. The defendant did not want it found. Again, we're talking about the gun that's missing. In closing argument, the defendant now seizes on the phrase, this isn't a game of hide-and-go-seek. But he immediately, almost immediately, follows that statement with a rhetorical question. Where is the gun? It's gone because he wants it gone. Viewed in context, all of these arguments are about the missing gun, not about the defendant hiding from the jury. And the attempt to draw that inference from the fact that in the real game of hide-and-go-seek, it's people who hide, not objects that are hidden, that's an awful lot of weight to put on something like that. And we think that's a failing argument. And so, Your Honors, for these reasons, we respectfully request that the court affirm the judgment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bindi. Anything further, Mr. Levenstam?
2 points on the facts pertaining to the gun. On cross-examination, Mr. Burroughs conceded that he had possibly seen two deputy combos in his life, and that's at page 2260, so it was certainly not many. And we know that there was no indication of the deputy designation on the handle.
Is this Helmut Schmidt company still in existence?
Herbert Schmidt? I don't think so. Don't think it still is. Oh. But I'm not positive.
One wonders why you don't just ask the manufacturer.
Yeah, I don't think it is. And second of all, with respect to the bullets...
I assume, given the rest of your line of argument, you wouldn't accept a reference to Wikipedia as a means of resolving any dispute.
I would not, Your Honor. With respect to the bullets, and this time, Judge Posner, I am not exaggerating. I'm going to quote from the text of the transcript. Millions of those bullets are made each year, and those are the words that came from Agent Tangren's mouth.
Oh, no, I agree. I thought you were talking about millions of guns.
So, yeah, well, I apologize for that. And the only other point that I would like to make about the context argument with respect to the focus on the gun is why would the government have to sort of make up the argument that the defense counsel never made about him? He doesn't have to testify about where the gun is, which the defense counsel never said, before saying no fewer than three times that he doesn't have to tell you where the gun is. I think that quite clearly this was an effort to get right at the silence through the gun and get the jury to conclude negatively about my client from that silence. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Levenstam. We greatly appreciate your willingness and that of your law firm to accept the appointment and all the time you've poured into this. These are very difficult cases, and we think you've done an excellent job with this, and we want to express our appreciation. The case is taken under advisement.